The title of our message today is Suffering Before Pilate. And if there is anybody who made a bad decision in all of history, it is Pilate. In fact, I think we could say he made the worst decision that could ever be made when he decided to turn Jesus over. Now, it's been said in his defense, he wanted to do what was right, only he didn't do it. But I don't really know that that's in his defense, is it? Because if you don't know the right thing to do and you don't do it, that's one thing. But if you know what is the right thing to do and you don't do it, that's something entirely different. And that's exactly where Pilate was. He knew what the right thing to do was, only he chose not to do it. Anybody here ever done that exact same thing? Don't raise your hand. We get a bunch of people to raise their hands up. I have. You have. And when it comes to making decisions, I want to make the right decision, regardless of what the consequences might be in my life. And that is what Pilate was unwilling to do. Pilate knew that if he made the right decision, there would be difficult circumstances for him to live by. And so he chose that rather than doing what is right. You and I have a lot of decisions to make. Some of them are big decisions and some of them are small. Some of us are very decisive. We can make decisions quickly. Others of us, well, we're not so decisive. Making decisions is extremely difficult, and it seems to be more so for the female gender. Not picking on the ladies at all, by the way. I said, it seems to be so for the female gender. I'm with my wife at the store, and she's trying to pick out a dress, and I'm like, just kill me now. Just get it all over with now. She's like, do you like this one? Yes. Do you like this one? Yes. Do you like this one? Yes. Do you like that? Which one do you want? Any one of them would be fine. Absolutely. Absolutely fine. It's like that commercial where the gal shows the guys the shoes, and it shows it from the guy's perspective, and they all look exactly the same. He goes, yeah, any one of them. And then they're all different, you know, to the lady. But to us, it's like, just pick one. Just do something. Or kill me. Get me out of this mall one way or another by making a decision. Whatever the decisions are, and of course there's ones that don't really matter, like which shoes you buy. Some of you gals, oh, come on. All right, so there's decisions that don't really matter, and then there's decisions that really do matter. The decision that Pilate finds himself making here is a decision that really matters. And we need to, before we go on and begin to read this account, we need to understand that Pilate was already in trouble. To be the governor of the region of Judea was like a communist officer, a Russian officer, being sent to the Siberian front. You were exiled. And so Pilate, according to history, had already made some mistakes. He was already on probation, we could say. And so now Jerusalem swells from whatever they normally were, 100,000 or so, to around 1 million, maybe even more. So Pilate leaves his favorite home in Caesarea, down by the Mediterranean Sea. It's a beautiful little kind of palace area that Pilate had there in this beautiful area by the sea. And he travels up to the mountains where Jerusalem is so that he can be there to make sure that these crowds of people swelling to, some believe, in excess of 1 million people in Jerusalem during this particular week, that he can make sure that they stay in line. So he is staying in the governor's headquarters in Jerusalem. Unknown to him, the night before, Jesus had been arrested in the dark, tried two different trials in the middle of the night. If ever there is a trial in the middle of the night, you know something isn't right. If it can't wait till the next day, someone's trying to move something through. It's like when we hear about the Senate voting themselves raises in the middle of the night so that nobody will know that that's actually taken place. And by the way, I think that they ought to get raises when you figure out exactly what they make, that they ought to get raises. But nevertheless, you know they're just trying to get it done when they do it in the middle of the night. Let's have a night session. Let's vote this thing through before anybody wakes up and figures out what we have done. Well, the same is true here. And so it's early in the morning. Jesus will be on the cross by 9. He will go before Pilate, sent to Herod, back to Pilate again, beaten, scourged, condemned, and then crucified before 9 o'clock in the morning. That gives you the idea of how fast they are pushing this through. So verse 28 of chapter 18. Then they led Jesus from Caiaphas to the Praetorium. The Praetorium was the governor's headquarters in Jerusalem. It's where he lived. The Praetorium had barracks, soldiers' barracks that were around them. It had an open courtyard area in the back, as it were, where they would torture people. Then they had a front area with a judgment seat where they would hear what, you know, the different things that people would be arguing about. And there were others that heard cases, but Pilate himself, being the governor, would have heard the most severe. And so they bring Jesus early in the morning to Pilate, to his headquarters, to the place that he lives. This is his home as well while he stays in Jerusalem. It says, and it was early morning, but they themselves did not go into the Praetorium, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. What incredible hypocrisy. They are murdering a man. They are railroading him through the system so they can have him killed unjustly, and they don't want to walk into a Gentile's home because it will defile them for the Passover. They are so caught up in the laws that they live. Jesus so rightly said to them, "Woe to you, scribes, Pharisees, hypocrites, for you strain out a gnat, but you swallow a camel." They were so concerned that they didn't go into the house of Pilate, but yet they were delivering a man up to be murdered. That is Pharisaical living. We fall into the same category. When we become so concerned about keeping certain rituals, making sure we do in our mind what Christians are supposed to do, and then we treat the people around us unjustly. We treat the people around us poorly. I am persuaded that God cares far more about the way we treat one another, the way we treat our spouses, the way we treat our family, the way we treat our mother-in-laws, the way we treat our son-in-laws, the way we treat others around us, then he cares about a lot of the religious aspect that you might put together. You might have your list. Well, I've stopped doing this, I've stopped doing that, I've stopped doing this, so God must be happy with me now. And God would say, I'm not happy with you at all because you're treating people poorly. That's why God said, if you're merciful, I'll be merciful to you. The way that you judge is the way that I'm going to judge you. And if you forgive, then I'll be forgiving to you. But if you're not forgiving, then I won't be forgiving to you. The way we treat people around us reflects the way that God treats us as well. They, in their hypocrisy, didn't want to not keep the Passover, but they had no qualms about murdering a man. Something was deeply wrong. Verse 29, Pilate then went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered and said to him, "If he were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you. In other words, they're saying, don't, you know, trouble us with the details. Just kill him. We've tried him. We found him guilty. Then Pilate said to them, "You take him. You judge him according to your own law." Therefore, the Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." Now, in the strict sense, that was true. It really wasn't lawful for them to put anyone to death, but in their Jewish courts, they did. You remember, Stephen will be stoned not many days from now, from this point. You remember that they tried to kill Jesus when he read Isaiah 60 in one of their synagogues, and they took him out to throw him over a cliff. And the Bible says, because it was not his time, he slipped through their midst. So they had no qualms about killing someone that they thought needed killing. But the next verse tells us what was going on, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which they spoke, signifying by what death he would die. Jesus said, "I will be handed over to the Gentiles, and they will crucify me and kill me." And so the Gentiles needed to do it. Now, I think there was a reason for this. I believe that it was necessary for Gentiles to be involved in the killing of Jesus so that people would not come back and blame the Jews. Now, I realize that many people blame Jews today for the death of Jesus, and anti-Semitism has had its base in that, or those who are anti-Semitic have no qualms in blaming them for the death of Christ. But remember, it was Roman hands that drove the nails through the flesh of Jesus. I'm not saying that the Jewish people of his day did not have a part in it, because they certainly did, but so did the Gentiles. If you want to know who's responsible for the death of Christ, look in the mirror. It's me. It's you. He went to the cross because of our sins, and he died for us. And so the weight of the death of Jesus falls upon all of humanity. And I believe that God wanted the Gentiles involved, that it was necessary to have the Gentiles involved in his death, because he was dying not only for the sins of the Jewish people, but he was dying for the sins of all mankind. Now Pilate entered the praetorium, again called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" They had said, "This man makes himself out to be a king." Well, that would be insurrection. And so Pilate says, "Are you a king?" Jesus answered him, "Are you speaking for yourself about this? Or did others tell you concerning me?" See, we have to make Jesus personal. And Jesus isn't going to let Pilate get away with keeping Jesus at a distance. I believe that's the same in our life, by the way. Jesus doesn't let us keep him at a distance. We can't say, you know, someone says, "Well, are you a Christian?" "Well, my parents were." Well, what really matters is not whether or not your parents were, but whether you are. It's been said there's no grandparents in the kingdom of God. You can't get to God through someone else. And so Jesus makes it very personal between him and Pilate, and Jesus always does that. He makes it personal between us and him. There's no one sitting here today that Jesus doesn't say, "Are you saying this because of someone else, or is it you that wants to know?" Now, Pilate's response, verse 35, Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew?" He says, "This is no concern of mine, really. Am I a Jew? Your own nation and your chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. Now, if you have a kingdom, you are a king." So he is answering him in a roundabout way. "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" He's like a good cross-examiner. He makes sure, he's getting down to it. He wants to know, "Are you saying you're a king?" "You say rightly that I am," Jesus said, "a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." That is an incredibly powerful statement, verse 37. See, today people will say, "Well, you've got to find your own truth. You've got to find your own way. And the truth is different for everybody." You ever heard anybody say those things? I know oftentimes philosophy classes at the U of A or at Pima or other schools will often have that emphasis. You know, truth is really relative depending on the individual. You've got to find your own truth. But Jesus said something different. He said, "Anybody who finds truth, the road that leads to truth, is going to hear my voice." There's one truth. There's not many truths. There's one. And if you're going to find truth, it will end at Jesus. Jesus said to Thomas, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. And no man comes to the Father but by me." Now, Pilate, he knows the philosophies about truth. They were just as much philosophies about truth in their day as our day. So Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" Now, had he been really asking that question, I would have loved to have heard Jesus' response to Pilate. But he's rhetorical at this point. "What is truth?" And he turns around and walks out. Verse 38, Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews and said, "I find no fault in him at all." Now, Pilate is what? He's a judge. And when he says, "I find no fault in him at all," what is the next thing that should be done? Releasing him. But he realizes these guys are causing problems. There's this whole crowd that's there. This thing could spill out of the area of the praetorium and into the city. And there's over 1 million people that are there. Rome might have to send down soldiers, and Pilate will be in a bunch of trouble. Pilate knows they're not going to be happy. So he tries to release Jesus in a way that will be acceptable by the crowds. So he brings up a man by the name of Barabbas. We're told that Barabbas was an insurrectionist, which means he fought against the Romans. He was a murderer, and he was a robber. He was a bad guy. And I think Pilate thought, certainly the people would rather have Jesus than Barabbas. So he brings him up. And the interesting thing about Barabbas, most likely it was Barabbas' cross that Jesus died on. That Jesus literally took the place of Barabbas. He was probably going to be crucified that day, on the docket to be killed that day. He would also be in the prison that was near the praetorium so that he could hear the crowds, but probably not Pilate. Which means that as he was standing there that day, he heard his name suddenly chanted by the crowds. Or as he's in his cell, He suddenly hears his name, Barabbas, Barabbas, Barabbas. As Pilate said, who do you want me to release to you? And the crowd began to cry out, Barabbas. The next thing he would hear would be when Pilate would say, well, then what should I do with this man? Speaking of Jesus. And the crowd would say, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And Barabbas probably thought, it's all over now. I got the crowds wanting to crucify me. Probably was the biggest surprise when he was released. Verse 39, but you have a custom that I should release someone to you at the Passover. Do you therefore want me to release to you the King of the Jews? And they cried out, saying, not this man, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. So it failed. He tried to release Jesus in that way, and it failed. So, verse 1 of chapter 19, then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him. This is his second attempt to release Jesus without stirring the crowds up. Here's Pilate's thinking. If I take him and punish him and bring him out to the crowd, maybe they'll be satisfied with that punishment, and I can then let him go. He already declared that he found no fault in him. When they handed him over to be scourged, he was handed over to be crucified. At this point, he's heading down that road to crucifixion. But Pilate will once again try to release him after he's scourged. Now, let's talk for a moment about being scourged. Have you ever thought, why did Jesus have to go through that? We know he was arrested. We know he was beaten so severely that according to Isaiah 52, he no longer looked like a man. The Bible says his appearance was marred more than any man. And then why did he have to be scourged? They would take him back to that place around the barracks, and the soldiers got together and mocked him. They chained him to that post that was in the middle. They embedded a large post into the pavement with two rings on it. They would then chain them to that post and stretch out his back, then take a cat of nine tails. And at the end of this cat of nine tails would be embedded pieces of glass, lead, steel, that when the nine tails would come upon him, they would lash him like a whip would, but those little pieces of glass and stone and lead and steel would embed into his back. Then they would pull out chunks of the flesh as they pulled the whip out, and they would do it again. Now the Romans lashed 39 times. You were sentenced to 40 when you were scourged, but because of mercy, they took away one. Not real merciful. There were accounts in history of men who died while they were being scourged, because it would often lay open your ribs. It would often lay open your spinal cord as it would tear chunks of flesh away. Some people would not survive this. Jesus would have been lashed 39 times. Now, I'm not going to do it today. I've done it before, and it's a bit intense. But if you were to count about at the rate that it would take someone to lay a lash on someone's back, from 1 to 39, it's amazing how long it is. It would be, you know, about how long it would take someone to lay a stripe on his back, pull it back, and do it again. It would have to be at this pace. 1, 2, 3. And you go all the way to 39. Sometime when you're alone with the Lord and contemplating on his suffering, just do that. Just count from 1 to 39, realizing that each time you make that, you know, you count that number, that a lash fell upon his back. And it's extremely long overall. It's amazing how long it took. Now, they did this in order to get prisoners to confess, so that if they would confess, the blows would become lighter. If they didn't confess, the blows got heavier, trying to get them to confess. But Isaiah 53 says, like a lamb before the shearers, he was silent. What could he confess? So he would take the full brunt of the blows all the way to 39. Now, why? What was the reason that he went through this? Have you ever thought about that? Wasn't the cross enough? All right, so he carried our sorrows and griefs in the garden. He was beaten for our peace. His peace was robbed from him so that you and I could have peace in the midst of difficult situations. Isaiah 53:5 says, he was chastised for our peace, and by his stripes we are healed. And the word for stripes means blows that tear the flesh. So it's being whipped. By his stripes we are healed. This scourging of Jesus was done so that you and I could be healed. Any of you that have ever been healed of anything you have prayed about, It is what Jesus did here that caused that healing. My mother-in-law was healed of cancer not long ago. She had biopsies. They found a lump in her lung. They had biopsies. They went in and took it out. It came back as cancer. They went in and took out that particular lobe, and the cancer was gone. She didn't have to go through the chemotherapy. It was by His stripes that she was healed. Now, what about those of you that have prayed and haven't been healed? And some would say that because Jesus, by His stripes, were healed, then all of us can have that healing. Well, ultimately, that is true. Because, see, healing doesn't only take place by us being healed by the disease, but sometimes we die from the disease, and then we are set free from that disease. Remember, when you die from cancer or whatever it might be, you are also set free from that disease. That is an ultimate healing. And we will go throughout eternity without disease. When heaven is described, it's interesting to me that it's described not by what's there most often, but it's described by what's not there. Like in Revelation 21, what is it, verse 4? Verse 3, I think it says, "And He will be our God, and we will be His people, and there will be no more tears, and no more illness, and no more pain, and no more suffering." It is in heaven that our illnesses are taken away. Now, I don't know if this is true, but a couple of medical books that I read a while ago, doctors that were talking about the beating of Jesus and the crucifixion of Jesus, just to kind of give a better picture of what He went through, have said that there are 39 categories of illnesses. Now, again, you know, I'm not a doctor, and I don't know. I don't know whether that statement's true or not, whether there are 39 categories of illnesses. But if that is true, if their statements are correct, that's a pretty interesting thing, that Jesus would have taken a lash for each category of illness that is there. Maybe you have been healed today. Maybe you will be healed in the future. But nevertheless, we all will have a part in this. We will be healed because of the stripes that Jesus laid upon our back. You know, it's interesting. I read a statistic not long ago that said if you live to be 109, and I should say if men live to be 109, that 100% of men that live to be 109 will have prostate cancer. 100% of them. That's why you have to leave you ladies out of that particular, you know, statistic. Well, all of us are getting sick. All of us at one point will be diseased. And Jesus, by His stripes, we are healed. I also believe that His stripes free us from emotional scars. Some of you guys have been emotionally hurt. So much so that you keep people at a distance from you. Because people close to you are the only ones who can really hurt you emotionally. If you're a stranger to me and you say something bad about me, it doesn't bother me at all. Trust me, I have enough strangers saying bad things about me and I don't care. I just go, just another person, add them to the list. But if someone who knows me, someone who's here with us week after week, starts to say something bad about me, it cuts deep, it hurts. Jesus died that those emotional scars could be healed as well. I also believe that Jesus died that mental aspects could be healed. See, I realize it's controversial, but I really do believe that there are mental illnesses. I don't believe that they're just demonically induced or a lack of faith. I believe that just as a body can get sick and need medicine, the mind can get sick. The mind is physical. Ultimately, there's all kinds of chemicals and aspects, and there's all kinds of electrical currents that flow through the mind. And when the mind stops working correctly, it reveals itself in a lot of different ways. And Satan's a creep. And he will take advantage of someone who has a weak mind or someone who is sick, has some kind of a mental problem. And I believe that there are drugs that can help. I've been around long enough to see people that I know who are normal and then something happens to them. And they are no longer normal. And again, if you're if controversy and if you don't agree with that, that's fine. As I've said before, you want to be wrong, go ahead, choose, be wrong. Nevertheless, it is my opinion that Jesus not only died for the health, the physical health, but He died for the mental health as well. Which ultimately, because we're talking about the brain, is physical. And we're talking about malfunctions that take place within the brain. And that Jesus died for them all. Now, verse 2, "And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns on His head, and they put it on His head, and they put on Him a purple robe. Then they said, 'Hail, King of the Jews,' and they struck Him with their hands." Now, Pilate has turned Him over as King of the Jews, and this is something Pilate will do throughout the whole time, so much so that he puts a sign above the head of Jesus that says, "King of the Jews." So the soldiers mock him in that way. They put this crown of thorns on his head, they put a purple robe on his back, and they sit back and they hail him as King of the Jews as they beat him. Once he's done being beaten here, crown of thorns upon his head, he is a bloody mess. As I said, Isaiah 52 says he was beaten beyond the appearance of a man. So he no longer looks like a man. He's been beaten that severely. Now Pilate, in a very dramatic move, and Pilate has a flair for the dramatic. He wants to bring Jesus out to him, hoping that when they see the severity of the beating, they will let Jesus go. And so Pilate then, verse 4, went out again and said to them, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you." He didn't bring Jesus out and then say, "Here he is." He came out, first of all, and said, "I'm bringing him out to you," because he wanted to set up a dramatic moment when they would suddenly see the severe state of Jesus. Now beaten to this point, "Behold, I am bringing him out to you, that you may know that I find no fault in him." Well, then Pilate, why'd you scourge him? Why did you have him beaten? Then Jesus came out, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." That moment was designed for people to say, "Enough, let him go." But it backfired on Pilate. Therefore, when the chief priests and the officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." That is the third time he has declared him to be innocent. The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die, because he made himself out to be the Son of God." I'd like to know what law that is, by the way. There's nothing biblically that had said that they would kill someone making themselves out to be the Son of God. Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was more afraid. Why? Because he realizes at this point he's dealing with a religious issue. We could say religious fanaticism. That's exactly what we're dealing with in the area of Iraq today. The civil war that is there is over different religious parties. And Pilate, hey, he's been around enough. He's been ruling enough to know that when religious aspects get involved, things can heat up quickly. So when he hears them say, not what they have already told him, which is he makes himself out to be a king, that's why we're bringing him to you, but that he makes himself out to be the Son of God, all of a sudden Pilate is more fearful because he realizes this is more of a volatile situation than what he had thought. And he went in again to the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" Now again, Jesus is beaten. He's taken back into the praetorium. Pilate walks in. Jesus has been scourged. He's weak. He's tired. And Pilate says, "Where are you from?" It's a curious question to me. It's like he's making small talk. "Where are you from?" "Well, I'm from Nazareth." "Pilate, where are you from?" After he's been through all he's been through. But Jesus gave him no answer. Why? What question wasn't worthy of an answer? Why would Pilate need to know that? Then Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have the power to crucify you and the power to release you?" Jesus said, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered you to me has the greater sin." From then on, Pilate sought to release him, but the Jews cried out, saying, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." Now they go beyond this religious aspect to, this is insurrection on your part if you let this man go, because you will be no friend to Caesar. When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and he sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, in Hebrew, Gabbatha. When Pilate sits down, Matthew tells us that, again, in a very dramatic sense, he has a servant bring him a bowl of water and he washes his hands in front of all of them. And he dries his hands off and he says, "I am free of the blood of this man." And at that point, the Jewish leaders in the crowd cried out, "Let his blood be on our heads and the heads of our children." Now, Pilate couldn't wash his hands of it. Pilate would have to live with the decision that he made. And it's interesting, when you study Pilate's life after this point, Pilate's life is never the same. I believe that this decision will not only haunt Pilate, I believe it haunts Pilate's wife. Because we're told that Pilate's wife sent a message to Pilate saying, "Have nothing to do with this just man, for I have suffered many things in a dream because of him that night." God had sent her dreams because it would affect both of their lives and this decision that they had made. You can't wipe your hands clean of decisions that you make. They are your decisions to make, and they are consequences that you will have to live with. Verse 14, now it was the preparation day for the Passover, about the sixth hour, which is still very early. And he said to the Jews, behold your king. They cried out, away with him, crucify him. Pilate said to them, shall I crucify your king? The chief priests answered, we have no king but Caesar. This is a statement they would have never have said before. But they want more than anything to have Jesus killed. They can taste it at this point. Then he delivered them to him to be crucified. So they took Jesus and they led him away. Now, three things in this study. First of all, that you and I would not be like the scribes and the Pharisees. That we wouldn't be so concerned about what we're doing religiously or church activity-wise or in our lives daily, that we would put that above the way we treat people. God will never be pleased with us if we do not treat people justly and rightly. That's what matters before the Lord. And that's what determines how God treats you. Not whether or not you've gone through a little list or taken care of things or you're doing something that some church or some organization says you ought to be doing, but what really matters before God is the way you treat people around you. Secondly, may we realize that every bit of the suffering that Jesus went through was for us. From the beginning in the garden all the way to the cross, now that we're done with the part of the suffering before the cross, next week and the week after, we'll look at Jesus upon the cross. We know that that's for us. But may we realize that he was striped for our healing so that we could go throughout all of eternity and not be ill. See, sickness, the Bible says, is a result of sin. And in order for that sickness to be dealt with, Jesus had to suffer and carry that sickness for us. And finally, third and finally, may we never make decisions like Pilate did. Pilate made a bad decision. He made it based upon his fear of his superiors, the fear of the crowds, and the fear of people. And if you make decisions based upon the fear of people, what people think, what your boss thinks, how it's going to affect you at work, how it's going to affect the people around you, if you make decisions based upon that, you will always make the wrong decisions. And you will suffer the consequences of those. And I'm not saying that the right decisions might not make you to suffer some consequences, because they do. There have been many who have lost their job because they refuse to do what is wrong. And they do what is right. But don't think that God would not be able to take care of you in the midst of all of that. Make the right decisions. And may God continue to increase our understanding of the suffering of Jesus. Let's stand up and pray.